everyone, and welcome back to the 13 Club podcast. My name is Kim.
And I'm Miranda.
And we are here for episode 25.
25. One quarter. 25 cents.
So.
US dollars.
What do you have for us today?
So this one is a bit weird because this is what I have is a true crime case. That this is one of those things where, like, the people involved and the, like, situation itself was so over the top that, like, it kind of risks eclipsing the fact that somebody actually got murdered. So I, like, this is kind of a tricky one in that I don't want to downplay the fact that somebody died, but the person who died and the person who killed them were both kind of extraordinary people. So this is a weird thing. It's a weird thing. And I looked at a bunch of different, like, sources on things, and I tried to kind of remix and rewrite into my own write-up of the situation. But honestly, there was one article that, like, just kind of nailed the, like, personalities of the people and the, like, bizarreness of the situation so well. I think I, like, ultimately, like, scrapped most of what I had written, and I've decided to just mainly read from that article to you. And I'm going to provide all the extra sources and background on our website when we put up our episode notes post to accompany this audio. There is a ton of extra stuff that I'm going to have available for you guys. But just for the sake of time, and this is going to be kind of long as it is, I just decided to kind of stick with the one main article, and I will, like, interject little bits here and there that are from other sources as necessary.
Sounds good. I'm excited.
This article is from New York Times, and so it's, like, unless you have, like, a free New York Times account, which I do, because I, sadly, we live in a day and age where you have to pay to read the news, and I don't want to do that. I have a free New York Times account, so, like, I was logged in and I could read this article, but if you don't have a New York Times account and you want to read this article for yourself later, because it will be in the episode notes, you can log in with incognito mode on your browser. And you can look at it without having to log into anything. Just as a tip.
Heads up. Yeah, pro tip. I actually didn't know that. I know that you can bypass it with, like, browser add-ons as well. Chrome browser add-ons.
Nice. Okay. Well, I used incognito mode, but then I remembered that I had this account. So, this article is from the New York Times. It is from July 6th of 2012. The murder itself happened in 2011, but us living in the year 2020, sometimes it'll say things like, this person is this, when, like, 8 years have passed and this person may not be that anymore. So just keep that in mind. But this article is entitled The Worst Marriage in Georgetown. And today, okay, we are going to be talking about the murder of Viola Drath. This may not ring any bells for you, because it did not ring any bells for me. I had only heard of this whole situation, like, a year ago. But it is, like, fascinating to me because it's just so weird. This is kind of, I don't want to say it's local to me, because I'm currently in DC, but I by no means live in Georgetown.
Right.
And to just kind of, like, set the stage for you guys. If you're not familiar with Georgetown, if you don't spend time in the DMV area, Georgetown is, like, a neighborhood or a district or whatever of Washington, DC. That is very, like, pinky out, is, I guess, one way to say it. It's kind of hoity-toity.
It's affluent.
It's very wealthy. It's got, like, a lot of, like, beautiful architecture and historic homes, really good, like, neat schools and churches. Like, and when I say, like, good schools and churches, I mean, like, these buildings are huge and, like, cool and old. I'm not necessarily speaking to the, like, quality of their schooling, although I'm not trashing anywhere. Yeah. But, like,
it's the literal college town for Georgetown University.
Yeah. It's full of, like, there's a their, like, shopping district is, like, name brand,
oh, yeah, there's, like, a Mac, like, there's a Lush, there's a Sephora, there's an Urban Outfitters.
There's a Michael Kors store. I think there might be a Gucci store there. Like,
I think there's a Louis Vuitton over there.
It's for rich people. And yeah. It's kind of funny because I was reading a few accounts of people who wrote into, like, Washingtonian, which is kind of like a local culture newspaper in DC, and people that knew her or lived around there. And they're like, everybody has such a, has the wrong idea about Georgetown. Everybody thinks it's super elite and it's this and it's that. But we're all just so normal. Everybody here is just really normal. And I'm gonna just kind of go on the record and say that's like bullshit. If you live in Georgetown,
it's like a bubble of just the rich and privileged.
Yeah. And that's even,
it's real. I mean, that being said, there's some great restaurants. Like, one of my favorite bakeries is there. Like, it's kind of like a fun place to visit.
It totally is. I'm not like trashing on it. I'm just like, I'm saying don't pretend that Georgetown is Main Street USA. Like,
yeah,
it's very cool. It's a cool place to visit. I think I went to my fiance's work had a few like office Christmas parties. They would like rent out a fancy jazz club in Georgetown, and they would have the office Christmas party there. But yeah, Georgetown is, I'm sure the people who live there are like all like, for the most part, fine people, but it's not, and like, it's even kind of like this like running, I want to say it's probably a running joke type thing. I always like hear people kind of like, it's really difficult to get to Georgetown if you're not like in a car or like an Uber. There are no metro trains that go to Georgetown, and there's only a handful of buses that will go out there,
and it's paid parking everywhere. You have to pay.
Yeah. And like, so like the kind of the unspoken joke is that like the rich people up in Georgetown don't want to have to like hobnob with the common folk, so they've made it as difficult as possible for you to get there by public transportation, because if you have to rely on public transportation, you don't belong there.
Right.
No one will really say that, but I think that's kind of like the way you're supposed to. I mean, that's how people feel about it, sometimes myself included. But so this is setting the scene. This is where this is for the most part taking place. This is me, I'm again reading straight from the article, but I'll like inject little bits here where I feel like it's necessary. Dinners were served in the basement. Ambassadors, generals with many stars, senior White House officials, and closely read columnists all would walk past the yellowing kitchen, which looked as if it hadn't been updated since the Ford administration, and down a narrow flight of stairs into the dimly lighted dining room. Guests were arrayed around the table according to rank, with the most important ones squeezed into the center. Although the old world meals could be quite elaborate, venison pâté, duck in bitter orange, they were prepared and served entirely by the host, a stickler for protocol named Albrecht Muth. And by the way, there's some German and also, like, other, like, foreign names that I'm probably gonna get real wrong. So please,
you can only try your best.
Please bear with me, particularly if these are your native languages. I'm probably gonna screw it up. Muth liked to refer to his Georgetown row house, which technically belonged to his wife, the journalist Viola Drath, as the Albrechtery. Guests at their dinners included Ann Patterson, Obama's ambassador to Egypt, Newsweek's Eleanor Clift, and Pierre Salinger, the Kennedy quarter, followed by his little white dog. Antonin Scalia was another guest, and Muth liked to joke about the time he asked Scalia to officiate his wedding. "Will you marry me?" Muth inquired. "Well, I'm already married," Scalia replied. In 2006, even Dick Cheney emerged from his bunker to attend a party that Drath hosted. The couple's cachet had nothing to do with wealth, however. They lived frugally, mostly off Drath's first husband's pension, nor was it based on their resumes. He once started a small NGO. She wrote articles for a German financial daily. What they possessed was an exquisite understanding of the anxieties of the city's elite, and an awareness of the power of eccentricity in a city that has little of it. Drath was 44 years older than her husband, a disparity in age that was accentuated further when he referred to her as Madam. Albrecht Muth had his own rich lore. According to one tale, he once planted a bug in Madeleine Albright's master bathroom, on behalf of German intelligence, although the device managed to pick up only the sound of running water. Another placed him in Baghdad, working in a furtive UN mission for Kofi Annan, or Uncle Kofi, as Muth called him. Even Georgetown neighbors who never attended his dinners speculated about the man who carried a riding crop and smoked cigars, which he kept tucked in his breast pocket as he marched past the preppy boutiques on Wisconsin Avenue each morning. After a neighbor once mistakenly referred to the riding crop as a marching baton, Muth sniffed in an email, "I am not Mr. Sousa." On August 12th last year, Muth called 911 and reported that he returned from his morning walk to find his wife splayed on their bathroom floor. A 91-year-old tumbling in a bathroom is hardly uncommon, so detectives didn't initially investigate her death. It took the medical examiner to point out, a day later, that her scalp was bruised, her thumbnail torn, and the cartilage in her neck fractured. She'd been strangled and bludgeoned to death. Drath's murder seized the front page of the Washington Post, which was awkwardly tangled in the story as the rest of the city's elite. One of the Post columnists attended the couple's dinners, as did the reporter who covered the case for the Wall Street Journal. Over the years, Muth flooded the inboxes of his media contacts with messages containing his thoughts on the day's events and knowing tidbits of insider gossip. Speculations about covert operations gone awry, or rumors about fights between top generals. A habit that didn't end with his wife's death. 4 days after he supposedly found Drath's body, Muth forwarded a note that he originally sent to officials in the Pentagon. He intimated that the police considered Drath to be the unfortunate victim of an assassin who was hunting for him. I have to take a slain wife out to Arlington, he wrote. Mourn her, then find her killer. When Muth first asked her out in 1982, Drath had been married for nearly 40 years. He was a teenage intern for a lesser-known Republican senator. She was a veteran journalist in her 60s. Muth flattered her by describing his devotion to her column, which he said he started reading in his youth. The schnitzel joint he picked was said to be Henry Kissinger's favorite restaurant in town. Muth ordered a bottle of expensive wine, and over the course of dinner, recounted the details of great battles, quoted Oscar Wilde, and spoke of landing a top job in the United Nations. Although he had only recently arrived in Washington to study at American University, Muth name-dropped like a native. He acted very entitled, and she liked that, says Catherine Livingston, a former executive editor of Town and Country, whom Drath had hired to edit her memoirs, which she never had the nerve to publish. Because Drath only hesitantly revealed her inner life, the editing of the manuscript required that Livingston prod her with uncomfortable questions. In one of her introspective moments, Drath admitted that while she didn't consider Muth particularly handsome, she found his appearance appealing. His family fled East Germany just as hers had, and there was something about his Teutonic face and blue-gray eyes that reminded her of home. She was also attracted to his lust for power, which she knew could be channeled into professional success. At first, she was dazzled by his potential, Livingston told me. Once upon a time, she was nearly as ambitious. After World War II, when she was in her mid-20s, her husband Francis, the deputy American military governor of Bavaria, rescued her from the ruins of Germany and transplanted her to Lincoln, Nebraska. Drath adapted well to her new life, even hosting a program on the local public television channel, but she needed more action than Nebraska could provide. She began jetting off to New York to cover fashion shows for a German glossy, while her husband, whom everyone called the Colonel, took care of their daughters. She was the husband and he was the wife, remembers Parker Ladd, a book editor for Scribner's who was part of Drath's New Manhattan Circle. On her trips, she befriended Norman Mailer, who later stayed in her house as he researched his novel Harlot's Ghost. She began writing essays about German politics for Harper's and Commentary. In 1968, the Colonel took a government job and bought the Georgetown Row House. Soon enough, she could quip, "When I speak German to Henry Kissinger, he starts talking like a little boy." Yet for all her status and success, Drath remained deeply dependent on her husband. When the Colonel found out that he had cancer in the 1980s, she panicked about the prospect of widowhood. Her friend, the political theorist Gary Ullman, came to stay with her following her husband's death and discovered the extent of her helplessness. One morning, she turned to Ullman and asked, "Do you know how to make breakfast?" Following their schnitzel dinner, Muth largely disappeared from Drath's life, but just months after the Colonel's death in 1986, he began calling on her almost daily. They would drink tea and stay up arguing about politics. Evenings usually ended with Muth sitting down to play at her baby grand piano. About 3 years into his courtship, he donned a tuxedo, carried a bottle of champagne, and proposed marriage. That she chose Moody, as she called him, shocked her friends and family. She had other suitors who were age-appropriate and respectable, but as she told Ullman, they are old and boring. Moody is young and interesting. He was also eager and pliant. Eleanor Clift remembers that he was something like her intern. Every morning he raced to read the papers and then brief her on the news. He assumed the domestic responsibilities that the Colonel once performed, only with great formality. When visitors dropped by, Muth would serve them tea, take an exaggerated bow, and quietly exit the room. It looked like his next stop was Maxim's, Drath's friend George Schwab, the head of a foreign policy think tank, told me being the person who wrote this article. Drath hadn't intended to marry a butler. Her memoir details their campaign to land him a high-ranking job. They cultivated Vladimir Petrovsky, a jowly old Soviet diplomat who ran the United Nations office in Geneva, flying to Switzerland and buying him an expensive dinner. After months of wooing Petrovsky, Muth began appearing on panels across Washington on his behalf, sharing the dais with people like Senator Paul Sarbanes and Joseph Nye, then the chairman of the National Intelligence Council. "It's amazing how he gets into things," Drath marveled to Ullman, who replied, "Viola, you're introducing him to people. It's because he's connected to you." Ullman was a touch too dismissive. Muth could be hopelessly awkward, incapable of small talk, prone to clicking his heels, but he could also display remarkable social intelligence. Betty Gookin, a longtime friend of Drath's, once gave him a tour of her house in the horse country of Virginia, leading him to a wall of ancestral portraits. Most visitors would half listen to a genealogical discourse, but Muth recited back her family history, drawing intricate connections. It was the same knack he had for scanning an organization and quickly learning its jargon and bureaucratic subtleties. In 1999, Muth formed what he called the Eminent Persons Group. His vision for the group was as grandiose as its name. He would bring together a collection of prestigious international thinkers to advise the UN Secretary General. Among others, Muth enlisted the Pakistani cricket star and now leading presidential candidate, Imran Khan, and former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara. A co-chairman of the group was former Prime Minister Michel Rocard of France. George Soros provided seed money. Although the EPG didn't quite fulfill Muth's exalted mission, it occupied an important niche, campaigning against the proliferation of small arms, publishing well-researched reports, and convening conferences in Washington and London. So, like, these are some names that if you are, like, slightly tuned into politics in the last, like, 10 years or so, you've probably heard some of these names before. And I think this, this is kind of painting a picture of the company that these two people kept and the way that they kind of ingratiated themselves into larger political circles, particularly Muth himself, and to a lesser extent his wife.
I had to, like, Google photos because I had to know what they looked like.
Yeah. The triumph of the EPG didn't gratify Muth's ego. It was also an act of revenge. His mother had dabbled in politics, working her way up the Christian Democratic Party, but Muth's father, a doctor in the German army, died weeks after his birth. For the sake of her family, Muth's mother turned down opportunities to ascend even higher. According to Livingston, Muth felt the decision had punished him, denying him the perks and privileges that flow to powerful families. Writing to Drath's grandson, he described the joys of breaching the elite, where life is great because it's fun. "People of power," he went on, "fire at a different level of the human condition." To attract eminences to his group, Muth began by ordering thick stationery that he adorned with a crest of his own design. He signed the letters with an impressive title, Count Albee, which Muth claimed a distant relative who had suffered a debilitating fall from an Indian elephant passed down to him.
You know, it happens sometimes.
We all got a distant relative in India.
Falling off an elephant.
Taking risks. And he operated according to some key principles that Drath described in her memoir. To score a big-name dinner guest or favor from a VIP in Washington, there was no point messing around with official channels or wasting time with mid-level functionaries. Underlings fear for their careers and are more likely to examine new acquaintances for potential peril. But there's an unexpected naivete among the truly powerful. They assume that anyone who has arrived at their desk has survived the scrutiny of handlers. Michel Rocard received one of Muth's first invitations. "I had never heard of him," the former prime minister told me. But Rocard liked the group's mission, and his political career needed new purpose. With Rocard on the masthead as chairman, Muth had no trouble recruiting other VIPs. When Peggy Mason, the former Canadian ambassador to the UN, received her invitation, she quickly accepted. "Of course," she told me. "I figured if these other eminent people were already in." In 2005, Muth sent a flattering email to Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Mahatma, who runs a center promoting nonviolence in Rochester. "He gave me the impression that he was highly connected, throwing around names like Kofi Annan like they were buddies," Gandhi recalls. Although he knew next to nothing about Muth, Gandhi accepted his offer to pay for a flight to Washington and put him in touch with important people. And that's in quotes, in touch with important people. When Muth arranged for Gandhi to speak at the National Press Club, one reporter from a, quote, small, unheard-of newspaper attended the event, as Gandhi puts it. But that hardly seemed Muth's goal. He had used Gandhi as the headline attraction for a dinner attended by high society people. Muth, in other words, perfected the methodology for his social Ponzi scheme. For parties, he would start with bait. He theorized that Drath's ties to Nebraska representatives in Washington, Senator Chuck Hagel in particular, would bring in other politicians. Muth would also approach military officials attached to the embassies, who he knew were often lonely figures in the town. he understood that their attendance would help him attract foreign policy columnists. The whole Western Alliance was represented, according to Roland Flamini, a former Time correspondent. In a 2010 email to Drath, Muth explicitly details his approach. You meet someone of import, check him out, determine if he can be of use, you make him yours. At some point, you must decide whether to run him as a useful idiot, he not catching on as to who you are and what you do. Before long, however, some of Muth's colleagues at the EPG began to catch on. He came to a reception in a full morning suit, looking like a German aristocrat out of the 1800s, Peggy Mason recalls. People got a little nervous and started digging around. His talk about having served in the French Foreign Legion seemed particularly absurd. By the fall of 2001, Soros stopped financing the group, and Rocard resigned. I no longer wish to work with Albrecht Garrow Muth, Rocard wrote, citing the brutality of his working method and his polarizing personality. Some obscurities of his past irritate some of our interlocutors more than ourselves, and this also has its price. From their first date, Viola and Albrecht enjoyed provoking one another. At night, they would lie in their separate beds, arguing in German. But every so often, their disagreements would escalate. In 1992, Muth was convicted of beating Drath, the beginning of a rap sheet that hardly reflects the many lesser occasions of abuse. Once, when they were staying at the Plaza Hotel, he threw her clothes into the hall and locked her out of the room. "He has all my credit cards," she told Gary Ullman on the phone, who rushed to the hotel and lent her cash to buy a train ticket back to Washington. Where Drath nursed deep feelings and wrote passionately about her love for him, Muth was in the relationship for something else. He described their marriage as transactional, an example of a Washington coupling where husband and wife merge in order to aggregate their talents and social capital. When a local television reporter named Chris Van Cleve asked Muth how his marriage overcame so many obstacles, Muth replied, "Why does Secretary Clinton remain with President Clinton?" Perhaps Drath should have suspected that he was gay earlier. He was actively having affairs with men. But once she came to terms with...
That's usually a hint.
Huh?
It's usually a hint.
I mean, you know. But once she came to terms with Muth's sexual orientation, he did little to disguise it. He even briefly moved in with a boyfriend in 2002. "He was the boy, she was the wife," Muth explained in an email he sent to his friends. "You have the one for one set of reasons, the other another. Their lives were fully integrated." They were so integrated that the boyfriend suffered the same abuse as the wife. When Muth threatened to kill him, he obtained a restraining order. In May 2006, Drath was eating dinner on her couch while Muth sat on the other side of the room, drunk. "Your daughter isn't a lawyer," he blared to his wife. "She's a saleswoman. In fact, she's a judge in Los Angeles." It might have been best to let Muth rant, but Drath defended her daughter, telling Muth that he wasn't smart enough to get into law school. According to the detective's report, he responded by swinging a chair at her, knocking her from the sofa, and then repeatedly pounding her head against the floor. The next morning, Drath escaped to her daughter's home and phoned 911. When the police finally arrested Muth, he left Drath behind, an exit everyone close to her hoped would be final. Several months later, the dateline on Albrecht Muth's emails began to read, "Villa Zarathustra, Seder City, Iraq." I think it's Seder City? Sadar City? Seder City? Ever since Rocard resigned from the EPG, Muth had tried to revive the group. He even demoted himself to deputy executive director and bragged that Kofi Annan's nephew, someone he called his Ashanti blood brother, would serve as the titular head. Muth also began peddling what he said was a plan for ending the war in Iraq. The EPG would bring together the various Iraqi sects, Muth hoped, a mission that could not be completed from the comforts of Georgetown. His dispatches were long and filled with jargon. He repeatedly apologized to his correspondents for his fatigue. "I am, to be blunt, somewhat a wreck. The eye is blurry, and I have this tremor in the left arm and hand." The focus of his efforts was the insurgent Muqtada al-Sadr, whom he referred to either as Muki or with the honorific Hojatul Islam, a word that starts with H. I'm so sorry. He said that he had implanted himself as an aide in Sadr's camp so that he could act as a double agent. While he advised Sadr, he would try and steer him and his Mahdi army away from violence. Muki was a vivid character in Muth's telling. He described Sadr's ill-fitting dentures, which caused the cleric to speak with a slight lisp. When Sadr worked himself into a rage, he would remove his false teeth, an inclination I always discourage, Muth wrote. While the Americans harped on Sater's role in murdering soldiers, Muth portrayed him as somewhat dim-witted and sentimental. One morning, Muth wrote, he awoke in Sater's compound to the sounds of a Prussian cavalry march blasting from the speakers on the minaret, which Muth interpreted as a loving tribute. From a terrace, he watched as the honor guard performed in near perfection the exercises of Frederick the Great I taught them, the goose steps emanating straight at the waist. Muth's emails reached the inboxes of the State Department and National Security Council officials who covered Iraq. He sent the responses he claimed to receive from these officials far and wide, although he took pains to scrub their names. These notes often chastised him. I cannot sufficiently stress how dismayed we are, one official lectured. In his missives, Muth assumed the persona of a world-weary freelance operator, comparing himself with T.E. Lawrence. He enjoyed angering the inept Americans who couldn't appreciate all the ways that he saved their bacon. There were others who shared this assessment. The former Pakistani ambassador to Iraq, a recipient of Muth's emails, wrote a column in the Dawn newspaper that credited Muth with restraining Sater. Perhaps Muth had been inspired by the sterling example of the Iron Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, who welded in modern Germany. When Muth forwarded this article to his friends, Eleanor Clift replied, this is an excellent piece with a perspective that is right on target and gives credit where it's due. While Muth wrote about reconciling Iraqi factions, he achieved another feat, reconciliation with his wife. She had a blind spot, Catherine Livingston says. He was her weakness, her obsession, her addiction. Just as Drath finished her memoir of their relationship, working title, A Thoroughly Muddled Marriage, Drath called Livingston to tell her, I'm going to need a new ending. Muth began forwarding his correspondence with Drath, hoping to demonstrate their return to normalcy. In the fall of 2007, he described his preparations for returning home and asked permission to bring along the Iraqi man who tended to him in Sadr City. Having the comfort of a manservant 24/7 is the one luxury this aging militiaman can afford himself, he pleaded. He'll be paid for by the Mahdi army. The manservant never materialized in Washington, and the note of gratitude he supposedly received from George W. Bush, quote, I wished you finally took citizenship, was a touch too familiar. When I talked to Albrecht, I'm not sure if he's in Iraq or next door, Drath told George Schwab. It didn't help Muth's credibility that when she answered his calls, the caller ID showed the number of a hotel in Miami, where records show he was employed as a desk clerk from 2006 to 2008, the very same period he claimed to be at Villa Zarathustra.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a long history of fabulists who have ascended Washington's social pyramid. There was the lobbyist Edward von Kloberg III. The von was an affectation, as was the title of baron he used and the silk-lined capes he wore, whose motto was, shame is for sissies. Which, I don't know, some days I feel that. Some days I feel that. Starting in the 1980s, he specialized in representing autocrats like Saddam Hussein and Nicolae Kusco. I hope I said that right. In 2005, he killed himself, plunging from the walls of the Castle Sant'Angelo in Rome. Before Kloberg, there was Craig Spence. In 1989, Time dubbed him Washington's man from nowhere, because he never explained the genesis of his wealth. While guests like Ted Koppel and William Safir attended Spence's parties, he eavesdropped on their conversations with microphones and two-way mirrors hidden in his home. Dressed in a tuxedo, he committed suicide at the Boston Ritz-Carlton after his enormous expenditures on male prostitutes were exposed. Then there was the pioneering work of Stephen Martindale, who legendarily invited Alice Roosevelt Longworth and Henry Kissinger to his home by telling each that he was giving a party in honor of the other. Washington's susceptibility to fakery explains how Muth could continue living his Iraq fantasy. Although there is no evidence, no photos, no sightings that he ever set foot in Iraq, when he returned to Georgetown, he began walking its streets in an olive uniform and a red beret.
Yeah, I'm seeing pictures of that right now.
I saw him in uniform at the Safeway talking about Sater, Roland Flamini recalls. His emails began appearing with the signature, Albrecht Muth, Staff Brigadier General. This would have been ridiculous, except that he increasingly spent time in the company of bona fide Iraqi generals. Baghdad's military attaché included him in public gatherings. When General Nasir Abadi, the vice chief of staff of the Iraqi Joint Forces, came to town, he attended a lavish dinner which Muth hosted in his full regalia. They were treating Muth as if he held some kind of significant rank, George Schwab remembers. Several Washington wise men treated him with the same respect. Thomas Pickering, who served in nearly every diplomatically naughty post in the State Department, responded to one of Muth's Baghdad dispatches. "Thank you for your fascinating reports. They are most welcome." When Muth asked him to contribute a quote to his Wikipedia page, Pickering, who provided me with hundreds of Muth's emails, obliged. To the extent Muth has been successful in aligning the Satirist JAM, or Mahdi Army, with the U.S. Army and the Satirist movement with U.S. interests, and there is some evidence for that, he has made a major contribution. 3 years ago, Pickering redeemed the favor Muth owed him for the blurb. His friend, W. Robert Pearson, the former ambassador to Turkey, runs a Washington-based humanitarian group called International Research and Exchanges Board. The Iranians had charged one of its program administrators with espionage. Pickering offered Muth's help. Quote, "I have a lunatic friend who pretends to have relations with the Mahdi crowd," he remembers telling Pearson. "I'll ask Albrecht if he can exert any influence." Muth reported back that he had relayed the message. "Muki is praying for her," he wrote. When the Iranians eventually released the administrator, a gesture that was most likely intended to remove unwanted scrutiny leading up to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's re-election, Muth was quick to claim credit. "Thanks again for once more being a miracle worker," Pickering wrote. One of Muth's miracles was an event he orchestrated called Iraq Liberation Day, and because Muth loved nothing more than a good acronym, he gave it the full name of National Observance of Iraq Liberation Day, or NOLID, on a brisk April day in 2010. Iraqi and American brass, joined by mothers of fallen soldiers, gathered at Arlington National Cemetery for speeches and the laying of wreaths. The pictures from that celebration show Muth in his customary role, off to the side, ensuring that the wreaths were laid just so. Qabad Talabani, the son of the Iraqi president and the Kurds' official representative in Washington, delivered the keynote address. At the end of his speech, he announced the next year's celebration would take place in Kurdistan. When the Talabani extended the invitation, an impromptu gesture of generosity, he had little reason to anticipate the intensity of Muth's reaction. A wave of memos arrived in his office, and Muth quickly scheduled a meeting. When Muth came dressed in uniform, Talabani couldn't resist asking about his biography. He starts telling me stories about how his uncle was the deputy chairman of the East German intelligence, and though that they supported Iraqi security services and helped build Saddam Hussein's intelligence network. Sorry, I, like, had a hard time reading that sentence for some reason. This narrative was horribly calibrated. Hussein, after all, had waged a genocidal campaign against the Kurds. So he's over here, like, bragging about having helped all of that to probably the last person on Earth.
Like, small analysis, but he just wants to, like, prove that he had anything to do with anything.
Oh, yeah, this guy had to have his finger in anything that was going on in politics, particularly in, like, the early and mid-2000s.
Yeah, because he knew he was a fraud.
Right. As Talabani stared uncomfortably at his aides, Muth described how he wanted to invite the enemies of the United States, the Taliban, the Mahdi Army, to Kurdistan. Once he gathered them, he would launch the mother of all peace processes. Talabani interrupted him before he could finish. "Good luck to you," he said, "but we want no association with you, the Taliban, the Satirists." The Iraq embassy initially considered Muth harmless. He organized lovely parties for visiting dignitaries. It was touching that Muth admired the Iraqi army enough to wear its uniform, or rather, what appeared to be a hybrid of Iraqi and Jordanian secondhand components. But the embassy caught wind that Muth had gone to the Pentagon, dressed in his uniform, handing out invitations to Iraq Liberation Day. A party costume was one thing. Carrying this charade into the inner sanctum of the U.S. military was quite another. The embassy strongly urged its employees to avoid dealing with Muth and asked the FBI to investigate him. On September 10, the State Department received an anonymous fax containing a diplomatic dispatch that a mole had sent to the editors of WikiLeaks. Investigators from the department quickly dismissed the fax as an uninteresting clip job, but as a matter of protocol, they phoned the house that had sent the fax. When Viola Drath answered their call, she instantly fingered her husband as its author. Although the agent couldn't be sure, he thought that he heard a commotion on the other end of the line, he later told the police. The phone went dead. He and a partner armed themselves and quickly drove to the house on Q Street, but there was no response to their knocking. When the agents later arranged to see Drath, she insisted that they meet anywhere but her house. She arrived at a restaurant wearing dark glasses, which she didn't remove until asked by the agents. Although Drath claimed that her black eye resulted from a collision with a banister, she also told the agents that she feared for her safety. could they deport her husband? She was terribly worried about his anti-Americanism and his vitriol, George Swaub remembers. She told me, if something happens, you will know who perpetrated the deed. During her years with Muth, Drath's social world slowly contracted. Guests flooded her home in response to Muth's invitations, but she lost touch with old friends. I have a terrible conscience about the fact that we stopped seeing her, says Richard Gookin, the former associate chief of protocol at the State Department. We didn't invite her over because we feared that he would come along. Muth's embarrassments were mounting. The pastor at her church barred him from the building. The German embassy axed him from its guest list for fear of his drunken behavior and curtailed its dealings with her. Muth no longer left the house much, except to smoke his dime store cigars. During the day, he lounged on the couch, writing memos on his laptop and collecting details that might help him maintain a credible front. At night, he often drained a bottle of Madeira, I never know how to say that word, Madeira, and read the English language press in Asia so he could send emails that presaged the next morning's stories about Iraq. Drath knew that he kept careful tabs on her email account, and that he would send notes under her name. One day, while Muth was out, she called a young friend and asked him how she could set up a new address. But she was 90 years old and quickly surrendered to frustration. Even though she was usually only a room away, Muth sent lengthy, nasty notes to her via email. He dismissed her professional accomplishments as fluff and gave himself full credit for all the late career accolades she received. One note boasted about his cunning, which he illustrated with an old story. George Soros, who financed the EPG, also told the French ambassador that I'm the type of man who would have closed the oven door behind him at Auschwitz. He meant it as a compliment, he told the ambassador. I pleaded guilty as charged. I don't even know what he's trying to say there, to be honest.
I don't either.
Like, but it doesn't sound good. It sounds like someone insulted him and he, like, spun it into a compliment because he's, like, a complete egotist.
Mm-hmm.
One afternoon last summer, Muth arranged a date with a Pakistani man he met on Craigslist. Perhaps out of deference to his companion, who didn't drink, Muth initially ordered a virgin cranberry spritzer, but as the evening progressed, Muth's drinks grew more potent and his behavior more belligerent, according to affidavits obtained by the police. When the pair stopped by a small gathering at a friend's house, Muth expressed his desire for dinner so emphatically that he grabbed another guest to drive home his point. By the time he staggered home at 10 p.m., he had difficulty stringing together sentences. The next morning, the same morning Muth called 911 to report his wife's death, Muth's friend wrote him an email saying that they couldn't meet again if Muth was going to be that drunk. Muth replied that he had no memory of the evening. When homicide detectives met with Muth the next day, they asked about the scratches on his forehead, a query the detectives noted that left him visibly shaken and caused him to suddenly recall that he had slammed his head into the kitchen door. Muth also claimed that he never touched his wife's corpse, but when detectives told him they had uncovered traces of his DNA on her body, he admitted that he had touched her hand. Later, in an interview room at the department's homicide branch, a detective asked Muth how intruders could have entered his home. He replied, "It's your job to investigate, not mine." "And what about the age difference with your wife?" "It was a marriage of convenience," Muth shot back. The detectives told Muth that they were taking a break and surreptitiously watched him from the other side of the wall. He rubbed his face and muttered to himself. A few minutes later, a detective returned to the room and handed him a cup of coffee. "It doesn't look good," Muth blurted. It took the police 4 more days to collect the evidence to arrest Muth. During that period, they forbade him from entering his home, now a crime scene, so he slept in a Georgetown park wearing a perfectly tailored houndstooth blazer. Muth never had much money. He received an $1,800 monthly allowance from Viola, but he dressed as if he had means. When he stood before a judge in a preliminary hearing, he wore his orange jumpsuit with an upturned collar, an unlikely touch of Saint-Tropez in Superior Court. During his first appearance in court, he complained that corrections officers wanted him to wear underwear. "I am a serving officer in the Iraqi Special Forces," he said. "We don't wear underwear." During his okay. I know. During his second appearance last November, he announced that he would serve as his own attorney and that he would begin an unlimited fast, which he vaguely justified as an imperative of his faith. Muth had only recently become Catholic. Antonin Scalia, he claimed, had sponsored his conversion, a perfect Washington detail, and one that a Supreme Court spokesman has denied. On day 53 of his fast, Muth instructed the court that under no circumstances whatsoever am I to be given any medical treatment. In other words, he seemed to be following the grim fate of Edward von Kloberg and Craig Spence, his fellow Washington fabulists. When doctors pleaded with him to eat, Muth told them that he was following orders from the Archangel Gabriel. They needn't worry. Okay. obviously. So he's going to be fine. Here we go. He's going to be fine. They needn't worry about his ability to survive, he said. He later compared himself to a camel and then to Jesus. By early February, the Department of Corrections transferred him to the United Medical Center, which had greater capacity to deal with his extreme dehydration and starvation, although doctors now regarded his condition as extremely grave. Then, just as it seemed the government would have to forcibly feed him, he resumed eating. The next day, according to court testimony, his doctor, a squat, balding man named Nadir Marsban, paid him a 6 a.m. visit. As Marsban entered the room, Muth bellowed, "I want to jump up and shake you because I'm not sure you're real." The doctor calmed Muth with a touch of his hand. "You know me," he said. As Muth became less frantic, he told Marsban that he was a general in the Iraqi army recruited by the Prime Minister to help build a dictatorship. The psychiatrists who studied Muth for months wavered in their opinion on the subject. Some evidence suggested mental illness, other signs hinted that he might be feigning his condition. At the end of April, the doctors concluded that while Muth might eventually recover his mental health, he was for the time being unfit for trial.
Yeah, that's what he was doing on purpose.
Marsban had difficulty talking about his patient in such cold terms. When he described Muth, his voice carried both the anxiety and compassion he felt for his patient. In the hospital, he pleaded with Muth to restrain his self-destructive impulses, and he pressed him to mount a more serious defense in court, even if professional ethics should have probably dictated that Marsban stay clear of discussing the case. "If they convict you, you're going to be in jail for years," he pleaded. "God will take care of that," Muth replied. "I don't need to worry about it." So that's where that article ends us in 2012 when it was written. And I believe, let me double check my dates here. He was eventually convicted. I think it took 2 years. Okay, so April 2014, there's an article from homicidewatch.org, which is about specifically, I think it's specifically Homicide Watch DC. But on April 30th, 2014, they posted the article, "Albrecht Muth sentenced to 50 years for killing his elderly wife, Via LaDraff." The criminal case against Albrecht Muth concluded Wednesday when Judge Russell Kanan sentenced him to 50 years in prison for the death of his 91-year-old wife, Viola Hermsdraff. Muth, now 49, was convicted in January of first-degree premeditated murder with aggravating circumstances. On Wednesday, he participated in his sentencing via video conference as he lay in a hospital bed, still too weak to attend court because of his prolonged fast. Drath's two daughters did not address the court but provided impact statements to Judge Kanan before sentencing. "I miss my mother, her wisdom, her advice, her assessment of political developments, foreign affairs. I miss her visits to my home in California," wrote Drath's daughter, Connie Drath Dwyer. In the pre-sentencing report, prosecutors say another daughter, Fran Drath, finds herself trying to navigate a world that is unrecognizable. Before delivering his sentence, Judge Kanan said, "Drath should have passed away surrounded by her family, not tortured to death by Mr. Muth in the middle of the night." Police found Drath on the morning of August 12, 2011, at her home in the 3200 block of Q Street Northwest after Muth called 911, prosecutors say. Muth was arrested a few days later and originally charged with second-degree murder. At trial, prosecutors presented evidence of emails between Drath and Muth, including some that Muth annotated. And one email Drath wrote, "I can and will no longer take it. I have been useful to you, and you have enlivened my life to some degree." Medical examiner Dr. Carolyn Rivercombe testified that Drath suffered from rib fractures, cuts to the body and head, and clear signs of strangulation, which resulted in her death. During sentencing, prosecutors noted domestic violence incidents dating back to 1992, when 26-year-old Muth punched Drath, then 72 years old, repeatedly in the face because she interrupted a phone call he was in. Prosecutors also mentioned that Muth has taken on numerous personas over the years, including that of an Iraqi army general, and during court called him a manipulative liar. Assistant U.S. Attorneys Glenn Kirshner requested that Judge Kanan sentence Muth to life without the possibility of release. "We ask the court for something that ensures Muth will not be out in the community looking for his next victim," Kirshner said. Before he delivered Muth's sentence, Judge Kanan called Muth a common serial domestic violence abuser, adding that Muth's persona of fasting, a religious relic, was a transparent attempt to avoid trial.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where we leave this case. In April of 2014,
And he's still alive?
To my knowledge, he's still alive. He's just in prison.
Wow.
But it's just, like, a wild ride.
Mm-hmm.
It's all these really big political figures, particularly people that were really big and important during the second Bush administration, especially. But, like,
mm-hmm.
politicians and journalists, writers, all these people who were in contact and attended dinners with and joined committees with this, like, absolutely insane, egotistical dude who would do and say anything to, like, worm his way deeper into Washington society.
And a very talented con artist, it seems.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people were really susceptible to what he did, and he was very successful.
There was...
to a point, I suppose.
There was also, and I'm going to include all this stuff in the episode notes that we put up for this, but there was, like, one that was, like, somebody who was a journalist who, like, lived in that neighborhood and got sucked into going into one of their, like, dinners once, and she, like,
mm-hmm.
he or she brought their son along for some reason. I think, like, he had, like, run into her while she was, him or her, while they were out with their son. It was like, you guys should join us for our dinner next time. We're having a dinner next Sunday kind of a thing. Bring your son. There'll be other kids there. There'll be other, like, young people there, so he'll have someone to talk to. There were no kids there. But, like, the implication was that, like, he took, like, a slightly abnormal interest in her son.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. It was just really, it was all really weird. There's a lot of people, and a lot of articles. I found some articles from, like, when the house went on sale. The house that they lived in and the house that she died in, the family put it up for sale. They were, like, basically took everything that was of personal value to them out of it, like, sentimental value, and then sold the house as is. And at one point in time, I think, like, there were photos of the house, except for, I believe, the bathroom where her body was found. But it was, like, full of her furniture still. And, all, you know, her shoes were still lined up in the closet. And her clothes were hanging up. And it was just, like, this weird portrait into what that home was like. But as it is now, I think I've only been able to find two pictures left from that. And it's literally, like, pictures of her shoes. And, like, a few other things. But I, like, wish I could have seen it because I'm, like, morbidly interested in seeing what that home looked like.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a fucking dick.
Yeah. What a weird, weird situation. And I think, like, it's kind of strange. This article didn't hammer in more. I think the person who wrote this, and I get it, but they were more interested in talking about him than her. But if you look at her, like, on her Wikipedia page and some other, like, memorials that people wrote in her honor after she died, she, like, wrote, she was more than just, they presented her in this article, she was involved in all of these different committees and stuff that he, like, founded. But she was involved in, according to Wikipedia at least, she was involved in negotiations in the late 80s that, like, helped with the reunification of Germany. And then she wrote a ton of, like, textbooks, and she, like, lectured at all these different colleges and universities. She was an extremely accomplished woman.
That's why he picked her.
Yeah, obviously. Like, I think, like, that article didn't hammer it home enough that, like, she had so many connections and was so accomplished, and that's why he latched onto her the way that he did. I don't think they stressed enough, like, what a, like, a really powerful person she must have been. It does, I mean, I don't know. She might have, I don't know. It's all weird. There's no point in thinking about what ifs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what if her husband had not died of cancer? Or, like, what if he hadn't met her? What if he had found somebody else to gravitate to? Like, he clearly saw a woman who was vulnerable.
Right.
And, like, just completely inserted himself into her life. It's a sad story.
Took him 3 years to do it, and he was determined.
Mm-hmm. It was just a really crazy story, and I wanted to share it with you guys.
Yeah, that was crazy, and I've never heard of it before. Also, I saw that Christoph Waltz did a movie about it.
I wonder if that movie ever came out.
It did.
It did?
Yeah, I was looking at it when we were talking.
Well, then I'm going to watch it. Came out
last year.
Oh, really?
And it's called Georgetown. It's not, like, super well received.
I'm going to look it up.
Yeah.
I think at this point I have to.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how good that is. It's his directorial debut.
I do like Christoph Waltz.
I do, too. So, what I have for you today is, like, maybe, I was going to say a bit of a palate cleanser, but then there is murder involved, so.
Well, you know, a little bit of murder here, a little bit of murder there.
Yeah. So, I'm covering the Rando Nautica app.
Ah, okay.
And have you heard of the Rando Nautica app?
Yes, I have.
What do you know about the Rando Nautica app?
So, I had not heard of it at all. Until a couple of months ago, I think I was on, like, the serial killers subreddit, like, r/serial killers, and someone, like, posted that TikTok of the kids who found body parts in a, like, traveling suitcase washed up on, like, a river, and people were talking about that at the time. I think, like, at the time, the TikTok had been posted only, like, a day or two before, so it was still, like, very fresh, and I got, like, really interested in it, and I looked up. There was a Seattle, it was in Seattle, I think. There was, like, a Seattle police blotter thing that was not that. Like, they had that up at the police blotter, and you could look at that. But then I found, like, another article that was talking about how there was a suspected serial killer in that area of Seattle. And I was like, I wonder if these two things are connected. And so...
It ended up not being that, but they actually have, like, figured out who did it now.
Oh.
But... So, I feel like this is super cheap, but I'm also reading a New York Times article, but I did my own research as well, so please don't yell at us about this. So, the reason why I chose the article is because they actually interviewed the creator, which obviously I can't do myself. So, the article is called, What is the Rando Nautica app really about? It says, an app that generates coordinates for adventurers claims to turn your thoughts into a reality. TikTok and YouTube creators want you to believe it, but you shouldn't. The article is written by Alina Wilson. The app led one person to a friendly dog in the desert and another to a field of wildflowers. One young woman, after making her college decision, followed the app to a field where her school's initials had been mowed into the grass. And then there were the friends who followed the app to a suitcase full of human remains. That is the gamble one takes with Rando Nautica, which claims to channel users' intentions to produce nearby coordinates for exploration. Think about the law of attraction meets geocaching. Rando Nautica makes a few asks of users. What would you like to get? Choose your entropy source, before prompting them to focus on your intent while it fetches coordinates. This process relies on location settings and a random number generator, which, despite what the company says, cannot be directly affected by human thoughts. Many of the places that users have been sent to since Rando Nautica have become available in February, or since it has become available in February, are unremarkable. Parking lots, grasslands, many bodies of water. However, interest has been driven by the spooky and often synchronistic Rando Nauting stories that have been shared on social media. While several of them appear to be fake, others have raised some cause for concern. The creators of Rando Nautica say that the app has evolved beyond their intentions. But what were those intentions? A brief history of Rando Nauting. Before Rando Nautica, there were Randonauts, strangers who swapped stories about their bot-assisted adventures into the unknown. They wanted to open their minds to the world around them and make meaning of life's coincidences. The bot's code came from a group of programmers called the Fathom Project, who were interested in, among other things, using the technology to ensure the randomness of online gambling outcomes. Joshua Langfelder, 29, discovered the Fathom Project on the messenger app Telegram in January 2019 in a fringe science chat room. He absorbed the project's theories about how random exploration could break people out of their predetermined realities and how people could influence random outcomes with their minds. Mr. Langfelder, a former circus performer, thought the code and its underlying ideas could be used to explore the relationship between consciousness and technology. In February 2019, while caring for his father who had just suffered from a stroke, he created a Telegram bot that used Fathom's project code to generate random coordinates. In March, he created a Randonauts subreddit, which now has 125,000 members. That has gone way up since this article. And in October, a developer named Simon Nishi McCorkindale created a webpage for the bot. That same month, Auburn Salcedo, the chief executive of Presley Media, an agency that creates brand integrations for TV, found the Randonauts on Reddit and offered to help Mr. Langfelder get the word out. On January 24th, Ms. Salcedo and Mr. Langfelder incorporated Randonauts LLC With her as the COO and him as CEO, she remains the chief executive of Presley Media, which handles PR for Randonautica. They released a beta version of the app on February 22nd. Since its release, Randonautica has been downloaded 10.8 million times from the App Store and Google Play, according to the research firm Sensor Tower. And keep in mind that this article was written at the end of July, and the growth just keeps going. After a few months of rapid growth, much of it propelled by TikTok, its downloads have started to taper off, according to the data from the analytics of the firm App Annie. In an interview in July, Mr. Langfelder describes Randonautica as a multimedia storytelling platform that encourages performance art. He said the overwhelming response has not surprised him. "I kind of figured that it was inevitable," he said, "because basically what it is is like a machine that creates memes and legends, and it kind of virally propagates on its own. On social media, the most popular randonauting videos feature eerie and seemingly dangerous situations that are dramatized through editing. Some creators have capitalized on the trend by posting exaggerated or false accounts of their randonauting adventures. The 27-year-old YouTuber Josh Yuzura, for instance, claimed to have been led to a crime scene. Mr. Yuzura did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Ms. Salcedo denounced such videos in an interview with the YouTube creator Bill's Channel. In a phone interview this month, she spoke further about the proliferation of fake videos. "It's so hard to manage because people are really taking creative liberties after seeing how much traction the app is getting and that fear factor," she said. So how does it work? On first use, Randonautica offers a brief intro and some tips. And in quotes, it says, "Always randonaut with a charged phone and never trespass," before prompting you to share your location. Then it will ask you to choose which type of point you would like to generate. The differences between which only matter if you believe the app can actually read your thoughts, before fetching coordinates from a random number generator. The user can then open that location in Google Maps to begin their journey. Randonautica throws big words out there like quantum and entropy around a lot. Anomaly also. Its creators believe that quantum random numbers are more likely to be influenced by human consciousness than non-quantum random numbers. This hypothesis is part of a theory Mr. Langfelder refers to as mind-machine interaction, or MMI. It posits that when you focus on your intent, you are influencing the numbers. Basically, if you're looking for any kind of peer-reviewed scientific consensus, that does not exist yet in literature, Mr. Langfelder said in a TikTok video in June, speaking about the theory. Instead, he pointed to the work of Dean Radin, a prominent figure in the pseudoscientific field of parapsychology, and the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research PAIR program, which has cited Dr. Radin's research as evidence. Randonautica claims that a 1998 PAIR experiment supported the idea that people can control a random number generation with their thoughts. That study was published in the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which includes work about the paranormal, spirit possessions, poltergeists, and questions about Shakespeare's authorship. In the study, PAIR's researchers wrote that the experiment was far from conclusive. It looks like they saw some kind of correlation, but they admit that it was weak and it needed to have further research associated with it, says Casey Schwartz, an experimental physicist and assistant professor at Ursinus College, who reviewed Randonautica's claims for this article. She did not know of any quantum system that could be influenced by human thoughts. Lisa Fazio, an assistant professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University, said that the more synchronous experiences were likely coincidences colored by confirmation bias or the tendency to look for information that affirms one's beliefs and tune out contradictory evidence. She pointed to a story shared on Reddit in which an Australian poster described being led to a map of the London Underground. Things like that happen all the time. It's just that you don't notice that map of London if you didn't have the intention already to be thinking of London, Dr. Fazio said. He also noted that coincidences are far more common than people realize. Mr. Langfelder dismissed such criticism, stating that the app was not created to prove a hypothesis. "I would say it's not some kind of academic science work. We're more like inventors than academic scientists." An update coming in August will feature improved graphics, and Mr. Langfelder said that a custom random number generator that would have a higher rate of entropy would be in the app. So technically, our MMI effects should be higher. He said, of course, as noted above, MMI is a theory that is not supported by science. Daniel J. Rogers, a physicist who has worked with quantum random number generators, called Randonautica's MMI theory completely absurd. There is no quantum physics here, said Dr. Rogers, a founder of the Global Disinformation Index. This is just people using big science words to sound magical. There is no actual science here. Quote, do not go randonauting. Randonauting became popular partly because of reverse psychology. Young people approach it with a sense of foreboding. Do not go randonauting has been a popular title for videos. Several people who shared unsettling stories about the app say that they have since sworn off it. Adrian Chavez, 21, was led to an ominous beach near his home in Orange County, California. A video of his journey posted on TikTok in early June has been viewed 4.5 million times. I deleted the app right after that, and I never used it since, Mr. Chavez says in an interview in July. The 18-year-old TikTok user who posted the viral video about finding a suitcase of human remains on the Seattle beach, whose name was Ugg Henry, like at Ugg Henry, wrote in the comments, the moment I got back home, I broke down and I still can't sleep. In an interview with The Atlantic, Mr. Langfielder was blasé about the story, which was covered by news outlets including King 5 News and the New York Post. Now it's been covered by everyone.
Yeah.
It's not the best press, but I'm not really that upset about it because it's kind of cool, he said. I kind of wish it was me who found it. Some adults have expressed concerns that the app's lack of safety precautions has a lack of safety precautions for children. Through Randonautica's terms of use, it specifies that anyone who is a minor must obtain parental consent to use the app, such as consent collected by email, making it easy for young users to bypass. Know and Tell, a child protection education program with the Granite State Children's Alliance in New Hampshire, has posted on Instagram telling parents to keep the young people off the app or at least supervise their use. It says, they have, their little Instagram thing says, does your child have access to downloading apps? Does your child use TikTok? Does your child have the app Randonautica? The newest trend on TikTok is called randonauting, and it is crucial that all parents talk to their children about this app and trend. This app requests your child's location upon download and then sends them to unknown and unsafe destinations. Teens across the country are documenting their randonauting on TikTok and sharing it with the world. Teens have no idea where they are being sent or who they are being sent to. This is another way perpetrators can gain access to children with ease. Hashtag I know and tell. Hashtag child safety. Mm. It was very apparent that these were young teenagers that were going to undisclosed areas in the middle of the night, said Jana Elsaid, the outreach project manager for the Granite State Children's Alliance. She described these circumstances as a perpetrator's dream. Concerns about human trafficking and personal data use are addressed in Randonautica's FAQ, which specifies that all location data is anonymized and only made available to developers, and that the starting locations are never saved by the app. Pokemon Go, which uses augmented reality to encourage local exploration, has handled safety concerns by putting Pokestops and gyms in notable public locations and encouraging their users to remain vigilant. And that was actually, what was the name of that? Ingress. Ingress was the original Pokemon Go. And all of those stops were created by Ingress users. Because Pokemon Go is just built right on top of it.
Right.
But Randonautica's safety tips are similar. Avoid dangerous areas. Do not trespass. Try to explore during the day or with friends. Randonautica's website repeatedly urges users to use common sense. The latest version of the app will feature multiple screens and pop-ups reminding users to use the app safely. Randonautica's executives said that they don't understand why people would use the app to seek out risk or harm. You wouldn't go out on a walk and say, let me think about seeing death, Ms. Salcedo said in an interview referring to a viral TikTok video in which an 18-year-old user claims that she set her intention as death and then happened upon a shooting victim. Yeah, let's see if I get stalked, Mr. Langfelder added, like, mocking that. Ms. Salcedo said Randonautica's legal counsel reassured her and Mr. Langfelder that the app would not be liable for any user misconduct. Is Google Maps liable, too, for giving them directions? Mr. Langfelder said. At a certain point, if somebody really wants to go out of their way to harm themselves, they're going to do it, whether it's with Randonautica or not. So I liked that article because it explained really like what it is and what it's based on and all that stuff.
Yeah. So when I had heard of it, I thought it was simply like geocaching in that. I thought it was someone uploaded coordinates and you could just go to them. I didn't know there was this element of random number generators and this idea of like setting your intent and it, you know, not, I don't think it, to say that it like reads your mind is maybe like an oversimplification, but as like someone who is a little bit like woo woo myself, the idea of like having an intention or a certain thing in your brain, and then that influencing a random number generator to give you an idea of like a place to go. It's all like I get it. I get what the intent of the app was. I understand it a lot better now.
But basically, people are just, like, going crazy with it, where, like, you know, we had the big wow, which was the dead body in the suitcase in Seattle, and then after that, it kind of just spiraled. Where, like, I've seen ones that people are just flat-out faking, like, ones of, like, a woman, like, in a dark clothing that, like, runs up to them at the end of the video, and then I saw one where there was a man with a knife that was shouting about paradise, and just, like, a bunch of other things that are clearly staged.
Right.
So people are just, they're giving the app a reputation that the app would normally never have, because I used the app, like, I definitely wanted to, like, do a test before I talked about this today,
okay.
And I just, like, I had to do 3 different locations, because the first location just took me to the middle of the bay.
Okay.
So, I can't exactly do that. And then the next location, I guess I did 4, the next location was in someone's backyard. So I'm not about to trespass on someone's house, so I didn't do that. And then the next one was, like, someone's front yard, and I was like, that's still weird.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not doing that. And then I got one that was, like, an intersection near a park, and I was like, okay, I'll go there. So we drove over there and literally sat there for a minute, looked around, and, like, nothing happened. My intent was to find something interesting to talk about on the podcast, but unfortunately I didn't find anything interesting to talk about. It was just an intersection.
Right.
And that's basically, like, I think the app is absolutely genius because it literally is just utilizing random number generations, putting a bunch of, like, ooh-woo words all over it, like quantum and anomaly and entropy and attractors. Like, it's definitely, like, eye-catching, engaging, and then people are, like, now they're meaningfully or purposefully exploring their environment because of these random numbers, which is neat.
Yeah, I agree.
But people are, like, of course, like, people always have to just ruin everything, don't they?
Yeah.
So, like, I just wrote down, like, a few, like, I watched some videos and the ones that, like, some examples of what people saw. Autumn Johnson 05 found a house that was sunk into the ground. Tifa Doll found a summoning circle and what looks like offerings in the middle. It was like, it looked like some real Wicker Man stuff.
Interesting.
Playboy Lizzie found someone's tent, and then she found these, like, weird wooden structures that were also, like, Wicker Man style. I don't know. I'm not creative today. All I can think about is the Wicker Man for some reason. And then Bilbo Gaggins found a spooky abandoned house. Slug Lexa found a dog who kept leading them towards their point. And then they found 3 trees in a row, and then they heard a scary growling sound and ran, and the dog ended up being, like, a dog from a nearby property. Killer Queen Bites found a children's clothes in a river, and then she said something about a finger bone, but then they didn't show it, and I was like, you're fucking lying to me.
Uh-huh.
Don't fucking lie to me about this. Marlena Sanchez found a dog and a water tower. Aubernaut found just, like, this art area that was, like, an entire fence area that was decorated as, like, an art project, and it had, like, obviously someone was, like, really just going ham with all of their, like, cool artsy stuff and birdhouses and planters and stuff, and I thought it was really rad, but she thought it was very creepy. And then I watched, like, some other ones that were just, like, terrible. It's just, like, a couple girls just being like, oh my god, we found a trail marker, this is so spooky. And then I found some definite fake ones. And then I found this guy who found, like, empty coffins in the park. I guess it's not really in a park, but it was, like, in a lot area. I found a bunch of empty coffins. So he went back with a Ouija board at night, and then nothing happened. like, notably our friend Nexpo, he went randonauting and, like, just literally found a gas station in a parking lot, so really nothing happened there. I just wanted to, like, yeah, authorities have identified the remains of two people found inside the suitcase. The suitcases were discovered last month. Jessica Lewis, a 35-year-old mother of four children, and her longtime boyfriend, Austin Wenner, both died from gunshot wounds, according to King County Medical Examiner's Office. The suspected homicides are estimated to have taken place 10 days before finding their bodies on the shores of Alki Beach on June 19th. Okay, so they arrested the landlord, is what it is. His name is Michael Lee Dudley, and he is expected to be formally charged with double homicide. A 62-year-old man, Michael Lee Dudley, is in custody for the murder of two people after their remains were located in West Seattle on June 19th. Let's see. So he shot them, if he did. On 6/19/20 in the evening hours, this is from westsideseattle.com. On 6/19/20 in the evening hours, uniformed officers of Seattle Police Department, SPD, responded to a call located in the city of Seattle, the county of King, and the state of Washington. The 911 caller was reporting that she and her friends had located a large suitcase on the rocks by the water. She and her friends opened the suitcase and found the black trash bag inside with unknown contents, but a foul smell was coming from the trash bag. When SPD officers arrived, they located two suitcases. In the suitcases, there were garbage bags that contained human remains. The remains would eventually be identified at the King County Medical Examiner's Office as Austin Wenner and Jessica Lewis. The KCME would rule their deaths as homicides from gunfire. Detectives learned through the interviews of family and friends that two victims were last seen at Ambon Boulevard South in Berrien, Washington. Detectives learned that the property belonged to Michael L. Dudley. Detectives also learned that his cell number is blah, blah, blah. They blocked it out. This is a lot of info.
Yeah.
Detectives obtained the phone records of the victims and learned that their phone stopped transmitting or receiving data at 6/9/20 at approximately 19:08 hours. One of the last calls from the victim's phone was to Dudley at 19:01 hours, and that the call pinged off a cell tower within a mile of Bomb Boulevard. The detectives learned from the witness that Dudley had been renting a room to the victims but wanted them to leave, and that he had been fighting with them. Detectives were able to gain a search warrant for the house, and it was served on 8/19/20. Dudley was taken into custody and taken to the SPD homicide office. During the service of the warrant, CSI detectives found bullet holes, bullet streaks, and spent rounds and blood were found in the blue room. Which sounds like, when they call it the blue room, it sounds spooky.
Yeah.
Detectives also interviewed neighbors and told them that they had called 911 on 6/9/20 because they had heard gunfire from inside the house and yelling from a male that said, "Please don't do this, just let me leave." Berrien police responded but got no response, and when they went to the residence, a witness told detectives that she had seen an outline of a figure of a person under a pile of clothes and a bloody arm sticking out of it in the blue room. She told detectives that Dudley then asked her to leave because he had to clean up his mess. Whoa, this sounds so, like, not real, but maybe. When she returned to the house, she asked him what had happened, and he told her that his gun worked and his didn't. Detectives were able to gain a search warrant. He admitted to having arguments with the victims, and because they were not able to pay their rent. And that he owned a 9mm handgun, and that it was in his vehicle that they arrested him in. He confirmed his cell phone number that matched the one on her phone. And when asked about the blood found, he said that Jessica had cut herself. Mm. And when asked if the blood was hers, he said he didn't know. He could not explain the bullets or the bullet holes in the blue room. It's also obvious that the room had recently been painted and cleaned.
I guess not good enough.
Lewis's aunt, Gina Jashk, posted on the GoFundMe page that she set up to find the person responsible, said, "I believe they got the monster who did this to them. Please continue to pray for their conviction in the court of law, that justice will be served. I want to thank the Seattle Police Department for all their help in finally being able to get this guy and anyone else involved. In the midst of their police chief resigning over the lack of support from Seattle City Council to the protests and defending of their department, through all of that, they never wavered on their professionalism and promised to help our family in any way they could. God bless them for being diligent through all of this and helping us finally sleep at night. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad that they handled this well, but I'm still not going to be singing any police praises right now.
Yeah, I'm glad that they caught the guy who did it, but I'm not about to be a bootlicker.
Yeah, exactly.
Just saying.
It's a little too far.
Just...
Anyway, I know that was a lot of info, but I figured since a lot of people haven't really covered what actually happened to the TikTok bodies, that is what happened to the TikTok bodies.
And I'm glad you covered it, because I bet there are a lot of people like me that their introduction to the concept of the Rantanauti app is because of that specifically.
Yeah, people talking about a serial killer. But it seems like this is probably a one-off.
It's a... I really, like, if anything, and I know there's no scientific data to back up any of this, but after listening to you talk about it, I'm actually intrigued and, like, interested in using the app more than I was before.
Honestly, I think it would be fun. Like, honestly, like, if you don't have anything to do on a certain day, why not? Especially since a lot of the points I found were walking distance from my house.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, it's a reason to walk to this point.
And it's...
And then maybe I'll find something cool, because I believe the universe has many surprises for me out there.
Right.
And maybe I won't.
And, I mean, even if you... Let's say you went to that, like, crossroads, right? And mm-hmm. So, let's say your intention had been, like... I don't know, anything. You know, give me, I want to see whether my, like... I'm going to have a good week this week or something. And you go out to that mm-hmm. crossroads and, like, let's say you see, like, a really particularly, beautiful little, like, patch of flowers that's just growing there or something. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all it takes. Like, this, like, to me, this justifies that, like, maybe I will have a good week and good things are coming to me. This, like, these beautiful flowers sitting here.
Right, and it's, like, not necessarily because of the app, but it's that the universe is sending you to that place so you can see that thing.
And
I'm into divination and tarot cards and runes and all that stuff. So, like, it's not that far out of my, like, wheelhouse of thinking.
It feels like a very it could be to people who are already inclined to think and feel and believe that way. Like, I think you and I are. It's almost like a modern, like, a kind of moving that into, like, a digital space.
Yeah, which is neat.
It's sort of like you see people who will write little, like, emoji spells on Twitter or Tumblr, mm-hmm. and it's like to charge, retweet to cast. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it's just, like, I think we're, like, people who are into that kind of stuff, we're, like, adapting to technology and, like, learning to, like, incorporate it into different kinds of thinking.
We're all becoming techno-witches now.
It's interesting.
It is interesting.
It's just, it makes you think, and it makes you get out of the house and explore and see places you wouldn't have seen otherwise.
I'm of two minds on it. Like, maybe, like I said, I'm, like, a big believer in the universe in general, and I don't understand the powers behind it, because I don't think it's, you know, I'm not going to get into it, but I don't think it's of human, like, that humans are really able to comprehend it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe they just used Randonautica, and that was the reason that they went there, but the universe wanted someone to find those bodies, you know,
right.
So that they could... be found. And then there's like my husband's point of view on it is that it was completely coincidental that they found that there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think of it either way, but it's interesting, and there's a lot to like think about and unpack, and some people might think it's complete garbage and some people might be like, hey, check this out.
Yeah,
but do be safe. My god,
be safe,
because exploring any like any place in general, it'd be better to go during the daytime. It'd be better to go with a partner. It would be, charge your phone. Don't trespass on anyone's property.
Drink water.
If you see something weird, like, don't go in there. If you find abandoned houses, don't go in there.
If you find dead bodies, tell somebody, though.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, I think that was really interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. I learned a lot.
I feel like this was kind of like a... concept heavy episode, but
a what?
It is what it is. A concept heavy episode.
Yeah, it kind of was. I didn't mean to. I didn't think about it until I was halfway through sharing the article with you guys, but I think I accidentally got into politics, and I didn't necessarily want to, but...
It's fine.
It's incidental when it's you're life. Talking about these kind of, like, Washington socialite types. You are gonna get right. into politics, but...
I honestly think I'm gonna watch the movie.
I think I am, too. I'm really curious. Plus, there are some movies that I really like that have some, like, really poor reviews, so...
Yeah, also, it might be people who are just, like, not interested in the case, or people who just expect Christoph Waltz to be, you know, a certain way because of his past.
I feel like him playing that character makes total sense to me.
Yeah, it's actually, I think it's very good casting.
Yeah.
She is Vanessa Redgrave, I believe.
Okay. Well, maybe that's...
Yeah, Vanessa Redgrave.
We can do that for our postmortem, is we'll try to watch the movie, and then we'll, like, do a review.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
One of our two partners, sponsors, affiliates, whatever you want to call it, we have the absolute pleasure of working with Grinding Coffee Company. They are a independently owned and operated Black, LGBT, and women-centric coffee company that is really committed to... not just the product they produce, but, like, the community that they're a part of. That extends to the places and the people that they source their coffee from, all the way down to the people that they choose to partner with. Choosing to work with people like us that are women, LGBT, working as small content creators. They put out an excellent, excellent product. I just finished off the last of my, they have what it's like a, like, country sampler pack where you get, like, little samples of different country origin coffees, and I just finished off the last of mine, and I am already, like, devastated that I'm out, and I'm going to have to order more coffee, like, immediately. It's just really good coffee. It blows.
Yeah, I finished my cold brew, and I miss it, because now I've gone back to, like, what I had in the kitchen before.
Uh-huh.
It's not as good, you know? It's just
it blows Starbucks out of the water, Dunkin' Donuts, people...
Yeah, and I was really, like, pricing it out too, and I told you, like, I think it's more cost effective to, like, for me, like, especially to make cold brew at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better for the environment for me to be, like, reusing my makers and stuff here at home instead of buying, like, because I was for a while just buying a plastic, like, gallon of cold brew
right.
every week.
No, and they, it's just, like, a superior product, a luxury company, but at, like, a very reasonable price. Like, you're not paying out the butt for a mediocre product. These are, like, real people support.
It's fancy. Like, it's fancy coffee. It's quality. Like, you can smell it when you open the package.
Oh my god, it, like, makes me melt when I open one of those bags. I'm just, like, weak yeah. in the knees.
It's like a warm blanket.
Yeah, if you want to treat yourself to a really, like, good coffee, like, if you're like us and you just need that bean, that ground bean in your life to get your day going... I cannot recommend them enough. You are supporting, like, a Black independently owned business. You are also supporting small creators like us. And you are really, like, treating yourself to something that we are, like, confident you are going to enjoy.
Yeah. And then, yeah. I was going to say, and you can save a little money by using our promo code,
yes.
which is THE 13 Club, THE XIII Club.
And you will get 13% off your purchase when you use our code.
Yeah, isn't that cute?
I think it's pretty cute.
I think it's cute. And you know what goes really good with coffee?
What?
Books.
A good book.
And if you have a book in mind or you're looking for your next good book, you can sign up with our Audible code and you can get one free Audible book, 30 days of membership, and 2 Audible originals. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/13club. There's no the on that one. It's XIII Club.
And in case you are the kind of person who is not familiar with Audible, for whatever reason, it's audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening to our podcast, we have a feeling you probably also will enjoy audiobooks. You need something to listen to while you're in your commute or doing your laundry or perhaps just stuck at home because it's a quarantine thing. And there's such a huge library, like a depth of things that they have available for you to check out.
Yeah. Like, every major title you can think of, if there is an audiobook of it, it's on there.
And you listen to a lot of audiobooks, actually, right?
Yeah, because I used to commute to work an hour every day, and I'm about to start commuting to school again, so, yeah, I'm going to be on that audiobook grind again.
So, I look forward to you, like, giving us some good recommendations going forward.
I have, like, one just, like, it's not spooky, but it does have, like, you know, fantasy witch content.
That's always good.
I just bought it for my sister because I thought about it, and one of my favorite books, like, of all time is Stardust by Neil Gaiman. Mm-hmm. And he reads the book himself.
Oh, wow.
And it is so, he's got a very pleasant voice, if you know who Neil Gaiman mm-hmm. is. He's got a nice British accent, and it's great. And I gifted that book to my sister, mm-hmm. and she's pregnant right now, and so she and Delilah are listening to it together.
And speaking of Neil Gaiman, they are actually putting out an audio, like, production, like, not just an audiobook, but a full audio production of The Sandman as an Audible original. And when you actually use our link to sign up and you get your 30-day, like, free trial membership, not only do you get, like, one free audiobook that you get to keep forever and ever, you also get to download two Audible originals. And I definitely would recommend that you check out The Sandman as one of your two.
Yeah. Also, I just, like, looked at the cast list, and I'm like, yes. Because you know who is playing Death?
Whom?
Kat Dennings.
Oh my god.
Death is one of my all-time favorite characters. I'm about to drop a Death cosplay any day, and I think that's awesome. I'm so excited.
I love Death as well. If you... I'm not gonna spoil The Sandman to you guys. I'm just gonna tell you to go to audibletrial.com/XIII Club, and get yourself signed up for a 30-day free trial, and please go listen to Sandman. Find yourself your next good read. Well, I hope that you guys enjoyed this week's episode. I hope you learned something new. If you decide to go out on any random nutting adventures, please tell us about it. You can reach us on social media or on our email, all of which you can find at our website, which is xiiiclub.com.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Twitter, we've got Instagram, we've got a Facebook page. Like I said, there's an email where you can reach us directly.
Also, let us know if there's anything that you would like us to cover that we have not covered.
Yeah, questions, comments, concerns, requests. We are open to it. Please.
And we will have all those links from today also up there.
Yeah, we always include episode notes, especially for our main episodes. Mainly. Not every postmortem needs them, obviously, but, you know, we try to, especially for these, like, bigger episodes, try to source our work as best as we can. And right. So you can follow up on anything that you're more curious about. If you listen to us on iTunes or wherever you're listening to us, please, like, rate and review us, and we would really appreciate that.
Yes. And it helps us out.
Like and subscribe. Smash that like button. Click that bell.
I mean, whatever you're supposed to do, I don't know, just, you know, interact with us, please. We're begging you, we're so lonely.
We've been in quarantine for so long, you have no idea how attention starved we are.
All right, you guys, you have a good and spooky week, and we will see you or talk to you next week.
Bye, guys.